Yosef reveals himself.
In Parshas Vayigash, when the brothers tell Yaakov that Yosef is still alive, and he is the ruler over all of Eretz Mitzrayim, and it says Yaakov didn't believe them, lohem in lohem, and then he saw the wagons that Yosef had sent, and only when he saw the wagons did he believe them. Rashi says, well, what does the wagons tell him? Maybe somebody else sent the wagons. So Rashi says that this was a certain reminder that only Yosef could know, because the last thing that Yaakov and Yosef were learning before Yosef was sold was the Parsha of Eglah. Of course, the Torah wasn't given yet, but they were learning the Torah even before it was given, was the Parsha of Eglah Arufa. Now, what is Eglah Arufa? Now, this is a pun, actually, because Eglah does not mean wagon. Agala is wagon. Eglah means a calf, but it has the same consonants. So, Agalot, wagons, is reminiscent of Eglah, calf. And Eglah, so it's a pun, but Eglah Arufa is a din in the Torah that when you find a corpse and you don't know who killed the corpse, so you measure from the corpse to the nearest city. It's machlokes from the head or from the feet if it's closer to one or the other. But you measure from the nearest city, and the elders of the nearest city then bring an eagle, a calf, and they break the neck of the calf, not in the Beis Hamikdash, but in a valley, and that is said to be an atonement for their sin. And the Mishnah in Saita says, well, what sin did they commit? They didn't kill him. And they have to confess, in the event we did not escort the person, maybe a person was killed because we didn't escort him, we didn't take care of him, etc. So they have to confess to Hashem that they did whatever they could to take care of strangers, and if they didn't, they need kapara and the like. This is the Parsha of Eglah Arufa. By the way, Chaim Konevsky's first sefer, it's really a classic sefer, because I think he was the first person who ever wrote on it. He wrote a whole sefer on the laws of Eglah Arufa. I mean, even things like what bracha do you make on Eglah Arufa? Like somehow he researched like every possible type of question, which of course he then used as an excuse to write 50 pages on brachos. I mean, he kind of took a prat and then he used it for shas sugyos and the like. Now Rashi only brings one pshat. Rashi brings that the agalos is a remez to the Eglah Arufa. The Medrash gives another remez to what Yosef is alluding to, and that is the agalos might mean a remez to the wagons through which the boards of the Mishkan would be transported in the desert. If you remember, Levi had three sons, Gershon, Kahas, and Merari, and they were given the responsibility of transporting the Mishkan in the desert. Now Kahas had the Aron HaKodesh and the Mizbeach, and they had to carry that on their shoulders. But the other things, the boards and even the tapestries, they were carried in wagons. Right? They were not carried in the shoulders. And these agalos are a remez to the agalos of the Mishkan. So we have two pshatim in the Medrash. If the agalos that Yosef sent are a remez to Eglah Arufa, or if the agalos that were sent are a remez to the agalos of the Mishkan. Now, the way to explain exactly what these two views are is to focus on another issue, a word of the Chafetz Chaim. What does the Pasuk say? The Pasuk says that they tell Yaakov two things. Od Yosef Chai, Yosef is still alive, V'chihu HaMoshel B'chol Eretz Mitzrayim, he is the ruler of all of Egypt. And it says, Lehem in Lehem. Yaakov didn't believe them. What didn't Yaakov believe? Yaakov thought Yosef was dead? What? So the Chafetz Chaim says the following idea. Yaakov could believe one of the statements, but he can't believe both of the statements. In other words, if you tell me Yosef is still alive, you're telling me he's still Yosef, he's a tzaddik, he's righteous. I can believe that. But I can't believe he could be a tzaddik and be the head of Mitzrayim at the same time. Meaning to say, I can believe he's still Yosef if he's not the Moshel B'chol Eretz Mitzrayim, and I can believe he's the Moshel B'chol Eretz Mitzrayim, but he wouldn't be Yosef. In other words, the Chafetz Chaim teaches that what is unbelievable is how can somebody reach the pinnacle of political power in a corrupt and decadent society and still be an Eved Hashem? That I can't believe. And the Chafetz Chaim is making the point that the nisayon of being politically powerful and wealthy might even be greater than the nisayon of poverty. Right? Affluence can be more dangerous to our spiritual nature than even oppression. In fact, historically, that in fact has been the case. Although we don't pray for persecution, we ask Hashem to give us, you know, freedom and the like. But historically, it's very, very true that the greatest growth of Torah has normally occurred under adverse conditions more than prosperous conditions. Because when there's prosperity, when there's civil rights, when there's liberation, then Jews can go anywhere they want to go. And unfortunately, sometimes the Yetzer takes us away from God. When a Jew had very few opportunities, they turned inward to Hashem and they turned to the Torah. Right? The great yeshivas were in Poland, Russia, when Jews weren't allowed to do anything, basically. And that's when the great Gedolim were produced. Okay, but be it as it may, this is the idea. Now, the Agolos assuage, the Agolos take away Yaakov's anxiety. Yaakov says, how could somebody be a Moshe El Bechol Asher Lo in Mitzrayim and still be faithful to God? How does a Jew survive the affluence of Golos, not the persecution of Golos, the affluence and power of Golos? And the Medrash is telling us, by the double symbol of the Agolos, Yosef is reassuring Yaakov that he has what it takes. Now, let's look at each of those symbols. Let's first look at the Agolos, the one that Rashi doesn't bring. The Agolos as the wagons of the Mishkan. Now, the Mishkan was the first Beis HaMikdash that we had. But what is the difference between the Mishkan and the Beis HaMikdash? The difference is the Mishkan represents portability of Kedusha. Right? The Mikdash, there's only one Mikdash, Yerushalayim. Harabayas. You can't build a Beis HaMikdash anywhere else. The Mishkan, however, was a traveling Beis HaMikdash, right? Every time they went to a new stop, this would be the Mishkan. Tomorrow, this was no longer the Mishkan because the Mishkan was over here. So the symbol of the Mishkan represents the idea of portability of Kedusha. Now, this is an important idea that can actually be misunderstood. On one hand, every Jew believes that certain places are holier than other places. Eretz Yisrael has more Kedusha. Yerushalayim has more Kedusha. Harabais has more Kedusha. Just as there's Kedusha Sazman, certain Zamanim are holier than other Zamanim, then certain Makomos, there's holiness of place. But holiness of place can sometimes be taken in the wrong way. Sometimes a person's attitude might be, oh, only when I'm in a holy place, a special place, am I able to serve Hashem. But when I'm not in that holy place, what can I do? That's a very big mistake. A person has to understand, simultaneously with your yearning for Eretz Yisrael and the Beis HaMikdash and everything else, you have to have a simultaneous idea that HaKadosh Baruch Hu can be served everywhere and in all conditions. Don't be mitzamtzem, don't limit Avodas Hashem to a particular time and place. Right? Because otherwise, in fact, the Chafetz Chaim says that that was the famous thing. When Hashem told Moshe Rabbeinu by the burning bush, take off your shoes because the place where you're standing is holy ground. The Chafetz Chaim says, Hashem is speaking to each and every one of us. Wherever we are standing, we have to make it a makom kadosh. Because otherwise, you constantly say, well, if only I was in a better yeshiva, if only I had different parents, if I had a different family, you know, if I had a different chavrusa. This idea of the other place is where there's Kedusha is a very big Yetzer Hara, in which you don't take the matzav that Hashem put you in and use it in a good way. So if a person, for example, has to go back to Chutz Laaretz, I hope everybody stays, of course, but if a person has to go back to Chutz Laaretz, don't kind of spend your life thinking, oh, if only I'd be back in Eretz Yisrael, then I could do it. Well, Okay, that's sad. But if you're where you are, you got to understand. You got to find Hashem there as well. You still learn, you daven, you do mitzvahs. You find that kesher. Same thing, you know, people sometimes came from Europe, where the Yiddishkeit before the World War II was so strong, so beautiful, although Europe had its problems too. People don't always realize. And then they're confronted with America, so sometimes they gave up hope. They said, since we can't replicate Yiddishkeit there, so what's the point? Well, Rav Aaron Cutler said, well, no, we do what we can in America. And he planted the seeds. He and not just Rav Aaron, but you know, people who were willing to say that we have to do it. So the point is, you don't become a prisoner of the past. You don't kind of have this vision of this ideal past and then say, I'm stuck. But you take the opportunity. So Yosef is telling Yaakov that the first lesson I have is that even though I'm in Mitzrayim, even though I'm not in Eretz Yisrael, even though I'm in Golus, even though I'm on Goyim, even if I'm in a decadent society, but I take the motto of the Mishkan, where Kedusha is not limited to a place, but every place you go has Kedusha. And if you internalize that lesson, you can survive the Golus. Right? So that's lesson number one. In other words, Yosef is reassuring Yaakov that he has the tools, the spiritual tools, to survive in Golus. And that's the idea that wherever you are becomes a Mishkan for Hashem. It's an important lesson. It's an important lesson. Otherwise, we use the ruchnius experiences of our lives to be marchik ourselves from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as opposed to understanding the new challenges that you have to face. Now, the second lesson is Egel Arufa. Now, Egel Arufa teaches another survival skill of Golus. As I indicated, why do the Zakenim of the city have to confess their sins to Hashem? Why do they need atonement? Why do they need kapara? Because in case a stranger who got murdered came to their city and was not fed or was not treated right, they're accountable for his death. Now the Malbim asks a very good question. That doesn't make any sense, because the guy didn't die of starvation. The guy died because his throat was slit. In other words, they're saying, we certainly fed the strangers, right? And if we didn't feed the stranger, we're liable for his death. Why are we liable for his death? I mean, he didn't die of starvation. He died because his throat was slit. So you know what the Malbim says fascinatingly? The stranger they're talking about is not the victim. The stranger they're talking about is the murderer. They're saying that perhaps, right now I know, you know this is a very liberal view, but this is the Malbim says, that, you know, blame society for the murderer. But you know, that doesn't get the murderer off the hook, but there is that idea that maybe the murderer murdered because we did not treat him, it's the Malbim, with kindness and compassion. And if he goes out and murders, we are responsible. So what is Egel Arufa a lesson in? Responsibility for the other. So Yosef is communicating by the Agalas two survival skills that a Jew needs in the diaspora. One is the portability of Kedusha, and the other is Achrayus for Am Yisrael, and not just looking after yourself. When you look after yourself, then Am Yisrael falls apart and goes, maybe in Eretz Yisrael, perhaps the Hashkacha Pratis is so great that maybe we can live that way, although even then it's not a desirable thing. The Beis Hamikdash was destroyed because of Sinas Chida. But in Golus, for sure, a Jew doesn't care about the other, we all get swept away. So the Agolais is a beautiful remez that Yaakov is afraid, how can Yosef still be Yosef, living at the pinnacle of greatness in Golus? The Agolais reassure Yaakov that Yosef understands the portability of Kedusha, number one, and Yosef understands the achrayas one has to have for Klal Yisrael, number two. At that point, Yaakov can breathe easy, and Yaakov says, Baruch Hashem, I now understand how Yosef can be a tzaddik, even in the Golus of Mitzrayim. Okay? So that's kind of the message of the Agolus, and it's a message that we have to take into account. We have to take into account as well. You know, the Talmud Yerushalmi gives the famous mashal how all Jews are interdependent. It says if 10 people are sitting on a boat and there's a hole in the boat and water's coming in under my seat, I can't say, oh, it's only my seat, what do you care? If my seat goes down, we all go down. And that's Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh LaZeh. That what happens to any Jew is what happens to all Jews. And we all go down if some Jews are suffering, particularly if they're suffering spiritually. And we have to do what we can, you know, to help them. It's not just altruism. It's also our survival. In other words, it's not just helping them. It's helping us. Helping us as well. And, as everybody knows, of course, you know, we've lost Rosh Shiva Zecher Tzadik Levracha, and he was a person really in a very legendary way by starting the yeshiva with Rav Schiller and also Rav Noach Weinberg and Rav Yaakov Rosenberg, also great, great people. So three of the four are not with us in this world anymore, but they really exemplified the idea of caring about Yidden, being makar of them with Torah, and recognizing that if so much of Klal Yisrael is not connected to Hashem, then it's not just their loss, although it is, but it's all our loss. We're diminished. We cannot have that relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and therefore we have to try to bring people to Torah as best as we can, and to do it with kindness, not coercion, not denigration, not self-righteous judgmentalism, which sometimes drives people away from Hashem instead of bringing them to Hashem, but in a kind, gentle, and honest way to try to help Klal Yisrael. And that is how Jews survive in Golus. That will enable us to be Makabo, the Pnei Mashiach. Now, the other thing I want to talk about, which I'll just begin as a question that you can think about, and I will talk about it tomorrow, is that... I have one more point about this point. This is... You know, Yosef named his two sons. Two sons were born in Mitzrayim. And, by the way, do you know the Medrash? I don't remember if Rashi brings it. The Ramban brings it. I think Rashi may bring it. I don't remember. Maybe you'll remember. That, you know, it says Yosef married the daughter of Potiphar. Now, obviously, she must have converted, right? But this is called Osnas. Osnas was the daughter of Potiphar. So there is a medrash that actually says she was the adopted daughter of Potiphar. And in point of fact, she was Jewish. And that is, there is a medrash that says that when Shechem raped Dina, Dina actually conceived the child. She got pregnant. And she gave birth to a little girl. And this little girl, because she was a product of a rape, although this is very, very hard to understand, she was essentially abandoned. She was like an abandoned infant, but they put a medallion around her neck. It's a very, very strange medrash because the behavior does not seem to be correct behavior. But a medallion was put around her neck in Ivrit, in Hebrew, saying that she is the daughter of Dina Bas Yaakov. And she found her way to Egypt, or somehow she was taken to Mitzrayim, and she was raised in the house of Potiphar. And Yosef married her because Yosef saw the medallion. It was Yosef's niece, right? You're allowed to marry your niece. So actually, according to that interpretation, Osnas did not convert. Osnas was a Jewish woman, and Yosef married his niece. Again, the Medrash is extremely difficult to understand. That why should a Jewish child be abandoned? Now, if you're going to tell me, well, maybe Shechem didn't relinquish custody, well, obviously, after what Shimon Levi did to Shechem, they certainly could have taken this little girl back. There was no city of Shechem after Shimon and Levi did what they did. Unless the Medrash perhaps means, the Medrash doesn't say before she was abandoned, it just says that she was taken to Mitzrayim. Perhaps she got lost in the shuffle. I mean, there may have been, the Hashgacha may have been that she was kidnapped by somebody, and she was lost. I mean, that makes more sense to me then. The idea that they intentionally abandoned her. But be it as it may, Yosef, of course, had two children in Mitzrayim. One son was Menashe. One son was Ephraim. Now let's look at the names. The names are significant here. Menashe, Yosef says, Nashani Elokim. God has enabled me to forget all of these sufferings that I have undergone. In other words, I've suffered so much, I've been sold into slavery, I've been imprisoned. Hashem gave me the ability, Baruch Hashem, to forget that and put it behind me. Child number two is Ephraim. Hifrani Elikim. God has made me fruitful, productive, creative, be'eretz on ye, in the land of my affliction. So there's something very profound about these names that really reflects the internal struggle that Yosef is going through in Golis. That is, the first stage in order to adapt to the situation you're in is, on one hand, remember, Yosef always remembered Yaakov's face whenever Yosef was tempted with sin. He remembered Yaakov's face, and that protected him. But there has to be a certain amount of forgetfulness in that life. And that goes back to portability of Kedusha. Because if your model of Kedusha is Eretz Yisrael, Yitzchak, right? The Yeshiva of Yaakov, Shem V'Aver, all those things. You're not going to be able to have a relationship to Hashem in Mitzrayim. Because you will have this image that is so perfect and so good. And it is so much of a discrepancy to where you are, that you're going to be paralyzed in that past perfect world. And you're not going to move forward. So in many ways, to be able to move, you have to forget. Don't let it obsess you that much. There has to be forgetfulness. But the forgetfulness cannot be total. Because God forbid, if the forgetfulness is total, you've cut yourself off from the source of Ruchnius and Kedusha that gives you the ability to deal. So, the two steps are, there has to be the distancing from the past, but there still has to be the recognition that Mitzrayim is the land of poverty, the land of spiritual poverty. In other words, it's a simultaneous or a sequential notion of forgetting, but then reconnecting to draw the energy and the Kedusha. I don't know why, maybe I guess it's the Parsha. I mean, I'm not talking to people who are going back to Chutz Laaretz. I don't know. So I don't know why the message today is focused on that so much. Maybe some of you are going back to Chutz Laaretz. But this is exactly the issue of people who leave Eretz Yisrael. You have to forget in the sense that you have to understand that even in Chutz Laaretz there's an achrayas to create Kedusha. And you can't be linked to the idea that only in a certain place is it possible. Because if that happens, you don't move forward. But at the same time, you have to know it's still the land of your spiritual poverty, your enslavement. When he named Ephraim, God made me creative and productive, and I grew. But it's still the land that's impoverished. Because otherwise, you're not connected to the power source. You're not connected to the charger, so to speak. Right, so it's interesting paradox. I'm not explaining it so well. The interesting idea of distancing and connecting at the same time. There has to be a disengagement and a reconnection, because too much of a connection actually means you're not going to see the possibilities where you are. Too much of a disengagement means you're not going to have the kedusha and the inspiration that'll propel you forward. And the two names encapsulate this kind of paradoxical disconnection and reconnection that has to occur on all of those different levels. That's why it's no accident the Torah was given on Har Sinai outside of Eretz Yisrael. The Babylonian Talmud was written in Babylonia. Now you might say, gee, that's, you know, why wasn't more of the Torah in Eretz Yisrael? Because Baruch Hu knows Yidden are going to be in Golis. That's his Gezerah. For so long, they need to know over and over again that Torah kind of travels, right? That there can be Torah here, there, everywhere. Now, once we know that, we try to go back to Eretz Yisrael because that's the Iker place. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu Bahashgacha showed us that Torah has to be able to flourish no matter where you go. And that's why so much of the Torah is a creation. Torah Shebaal Peh is a creation of Chutz Laaretz. Okay.